Hello and welcome to Yesterday's News, the podcast that brings you the biggest stories from this week in history. And I hope you had a lovely Christmas. I'm Joe Forrester and I'll be guiding you through the historical headlines from the earth-shattering to the absurd. And this is a very special Best Bits edition for New Year's. In the next half hour, I'll bring you some of my favourite bits from the first 10 weeks of the podcast. Remember, you can follow the show at Very Old News and please do get involved. No tweet is too trivial for our attention. On with the show. Hello, it's the 26th of November 1922 and you join us live from just outside Thebes, Egypt, in a sacred and eerie place called the Valley of the Kings. We are with explorer Howard Carter, who is just about to take our reporter Joe Clark inside the recently discovered tomb of what is thought to be an Egyptian pharaoh and that has remained undisturbed for millennia. Joe.
Thanks, Joe. I'm here with Howard Carter, who is about to open the first door. This is history in the making.
Okay, yesterday we opened a door and found numerous seals pertaining to the necropolis, the city of the dead, and others to the boy pharaoh Tutankhamun, who died almost 2,500 years ago. We found our way down a passage, littered with objects that suggested looting, and after clearing some 9 metres of it this morning, we came upon another door, marked with the seal of the pharaoh, which we are now about to enter.
Okay, so Mr. Carter is pushing the door open. What do you see?
Quick! Somebody fetch me some candles! It appears to be a chamber of some sort. It's wonderful. There are two strange ebony black effigies of a king, gold-sandaled, bearing staff and mace. I see gilded couches in strange forms, lion-headed, Hathor-headed, and beast-infernal. They're exquisitely painted, inlaid and ornamental caskets. Flowers, alabaster vases, and some beautifully executed lotus and papyrus device. Strange black shrines with a gilded monster snake appearing from within. Quite ordinary looking white chests. Finely carved chairs, a golden inlaid throne, a heap of large, curious white overformed boxes. And beneath our very eyes, on the threshold, a lovely lotiform wishing cup in translucent alabaster. Stalls of all shapes and design, of both common and rare materials. And lastly, a confusion of overturned parts of chariots glinting with gold, peering at me from behind what must have been a mannequin. And I see another door between the sentinel statues. That must be the grave itself. But hang on, it's out! Out, everybody out!
What is it?
It's lunch, mate. The boots in Thebes only do a meal deal till half one, so chop chop. Thanks, Joe. Yes, Carter had indeed discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun, who died in 1346 BC, and with it opened the door to an unending fascination with Egypt and the curse of the pharaohs. Pharaohs. Within 12 years, 8 of the 58 who were present at the opening of the sarcophagus itself were dead, most notably Lord Carnarvon, who'd accompanied Carter into the tomb and died early the next year after being stung by a mosquito and then accidentally opening the cut while shaving, leading to blood poisoning and death. When the body of the mummified Tutankhamun was finally examined, he was found to also have a cut on his left cheek, leading to claims it was similar to that of Carnarvon's. Spooky. Carter himself also experienced strange goings-on, as a messenger approaching his house on the very day the tomb was opened was astonished to see a cobra inside the birdcage which hung outside Carter's residence, with Carter's pet canary in its mouth. The cobra was the traditional symbol of the pharaohs, so on the same day Carter had broken into Tutankhamun's home, so too had he broken into his. A number of people were to perish in the following years, and Carter himself noted his surprise at seeing jackals which resembled the god Anubis, something he had never encountered in over 35 years working in the region. Also rather oddly, Sir Bruce Ingram, a friend of Carter's, was given a tasteful sounding paperweight with a mummified hand in it, wearing a scarab bracelet inscribed with the words, "Cursed be he who moves my body. To him shall come fire, water, and pestilence." Ingram's house promptly burned down, was rebuilt, and then destroyed in a flood. Imagine sticking that on an insurance claim. First up, it's the 12th of November 1912, and we go live to Joe Forrester with sad news from the Antarctic.
That's right, Joe. Today, the frozen bodies of Captain Robert Scott,
Dr. Edward Wilson and Lieutenant Henry Bowers have been discovered just a few miles from a fuel and supply depot. Captain Scott's diary, outlining the group's tragic final days, was also found with them. The expedition set out to try and beat a Norwegian team to the South Pole last October, and today we've confirmed that none survived. In addition to the three men found today, the other two members of the group, Captain Lawrence Oates and Petty Officer Edgar Evans, are also unaccounted for. But Captain Scott's tragic diary may shed some light on the fate of himself and his team. Back to you, Joe. Captain Robert Scott was a British naval officer and an explorer who'd set out in October 1911 to try and beat a rival Norwegian team to the South Pole. However, his expedition was doomed to failure as the Norwegians used sled dogs suited to the conditions, whereas Scott and his team favoured horses, which all died en route to the pole and forced them to continue the journey on foot. Braving temperatures of minus 45 degrees Fahrenheit and freezing blizzards, they reached their objective on January the 17th, only to find out their rivals had beaten them to it, something Scott records in his famous diary, writing, "The pole, yes, but under very different circumstances from those expected." Scott wasn't to know, but the Norwegians had actually got there 4 weeks previously. Scott's diary has become one of the tragic records of recent British history, not only detailing their struggle to the pole, but their doomed journey back, during which his companions began to fall. Scott recorded on February 17th, "A very terrible day. Evans looked a little better after a good sleep and declared, as he always did, that he was quite well." Scott goes on to detail how Evans had then flagged and fallen behind the group, and when they returned to check on him, "He was on his knees, with clothing disarranged, hands uncovered and frostbitten, and a wild look in his eyes." Eventually, Scott writes, "He died, quietly, at 12:30 a.m. Perhaps the most famous entry in Scott's diary records the passing of Captain Lawrence Oates on March the 16th or the 17th, as Scott had lost track of dates by this time, in which he records Oates persevering despite intense physical struggles, before sadly noting, "Oates' last thoughts were of his mother, but immediately before, he took pride in thinking that his regiment would be pleased with the bold way in which he met his death. We can testify to his bravery. He has borne intense suffering for weeks without complaint, and to the very last was able and willing to discuss outside subjects. He did not, would not, give up hope till the very end. He was a brave soul. This was the end. He slept through the night before last, hoping not to wake, but he woke in the morning yesterday." Scott then records Oates' last words and the moment that has immortalised him as a hero. "It was blowing a blizzard. He said, 'I'm just going outside and maybe some time.' He went out into the blizzard and we have not seen him since." Robert Scott, Henry Bowers and Edward Wilson finally succumbed to the elements sometime around the end of March, with Scott's final diary entry being on the 29th. He wrote, "Every day we've been ready to start for our depot 11 miles away. But outside the door of the tent, it remains a scene of whirling drift. I do not think we can hope for any better things now. We shall stick it out to the end. But we are getting weaker, of course, and the end cannot be far. It seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more. R. Scott." He then goes on to write, "Last entry. For God's sake, look after our people." The frozen bodies of Scott and his companions were found on November the 12th, 1912, 8 months after they died, and led to a national outpouring of grief in Britain. However, the stoicism and bravery with which they all met their end means Scott's doomed expedition has long been held up as a fine example of the British spirit. Next, we're in Plymouth, where Nicole Holliday is aboard the Pelican with its captain, Sir Francis Drake, as he gets ready to set out on an epic voyage. Nicole.
Thanks, Joe. As you said, I'm here with the expedition's leader, Sir Francis. What do you hope to achieve on this voyage?
Well, Nicole, I'm glad you asked. Nothing more than excitement, adventure and a healthy dollop of angry Spaniards to our wager. What?
Okay. But what is your mission?
Well, my dear, our glorious Queen, God save the Queen, has charged me with sailing to the Americas just to make sure those pesky Spanish aren't up to anything untoward.
What do you say to those who claim you're little more than a pirate on a state-sponsored mission to rob the Spanish?
Who said that? A Catholic, I'll wager. Will you point him out to me and I'll box his ears? Listen, we're little more than honest, God-fearing Englishmen. And if we happen to come home from our little trip with a shit ton of gold and leaving a few dead Spaniards behind, then that must be God's will.
I guess so. Good luck.
Thanks, darling. One thing, though, I'm just not happy with the name of this ship. Thanks, Nicole. Yes, Drake's ship was renamed the Golden Hind mid-voyage, and the ship, along with its captain, would become the stuff of legend. After losing a couple of ships to adverse weather, Drake pitched up at Valparaiso in Chile, giving the Spanish garrison there something of a shock as he plundered it, before attacking Callao and then capturing a Spanish ship laden with treasure. He then sailed at the west coast of what is now the USA, repairing in the San Francisco Bay and stopping just long enough to name the region New Albion and declare it the territory of Elizabeth I. Huzzah! Drake then set off across the Pacific, sailed around the Cape of Good Hope, and got back to Plymouth in September 1580, over 2.5 years after setting out, and with so much treasure that a grateful Queen Elizabeth knighted him on the deck of his famous ship. Drake was a pirate, although he would have seen himself as a soldier and a patriot, I'm sure, and Queen Elizabeth gleefully encouraged his daring escapades. However, this policy led to increasing tensions with the superpower of the age, Catholic Spain, and the famous Spanish Armada set sail for England in 1588 with the intention of deposing and executing the troublesome Protestant queen. Inevitably, being the irascible buccaneer that he was, Drake played a pivotal role in the defeat of the Armada. He had in fact delayed the invasion by over a year when he raided Cadiz in 1587, destroying much of the Spanish fleet there. An act that was so daring and close to the heart of Spanish power, he was said to have singed the King of Spain's beard. Legend has it Drake was playing bowls when he was told the Armada was approaching in 1588, but he coolly told the agitated messenger that there was plenty of time to finish his game and still defeat the Spanish. He also helped organise the fire ships which so disrupted the formation of the Armada, and naturally found time to capture a Spanish galleon heaving with gold. Fittingly, Drake's life came to an end while on campaign in South America in 1595, when he died of dysentery. He asked to be buried in full armour and his lead-lined casket was cast into the sea. Drake is a towering figure in English history and, with some justification, can be seen as the perfect example of the debonair, swashbuckling and daring adventurer of the Elizabethan age. It's tough to undertake high treason.
Precisely.
With people, if you've got shared bathroom.
Yeah. Ensuite, mate, come on.
Have you?
Yeah.
Living the life.
Thank you.
Shower and bath?
Just a shower.
Hey. It's okay, though.
It is okay. It's literally just okay. I'm going to answer it from my mum and dad's house.
Right.
See, a box under the bed is too obvious.
Mm.
You want something which... Do you have like a drawer in the kitchen which has got like chocolate spread in?
Not in a drawer. You keep it in the cupboard.
Cupboard. That's what I meant. Just somewhere that has really obscure things that don't get touched much. Jam.
Well, there's honey that I've had in cupboards for the entire length of my time in the house.
Mm.
And I've never once thought, oh, I'll have a bit of honey. I'll have a bit of honey, darling. Honey, apparently, as well, was found in tombs of Egyptian pharaohs.
Yeah.
Still fresh.
Really?
Yes. But not like days after they were buried. Like, yeah, several thousand years. So 2,500 years later.
Good Lord.
It remains fresh. It's something about the... I've got absolutely no idea what it is that does it. Someone please tweet in at Very Old News and tell us why honey remains fresh.
Really? Like, if you get a pot like a Winnie the Pooh thing.
Yeah.
No one's going to like me going through it.
Those pots that he has in Winnie the Pooh, they're sort of... They're a bit like the jugs that simpletons in sort of cartoons of the deep south of America. They're like, that's where I keep my sipping whiskey. It's like a jug like that.
It literally is, actually.
Yeah, but Winnie the Pooh keeps his honey in it.
Yeah.
He might just been on the piss the whole time. He doesn't wear trousers.
He doesn't.
He's got a little red t-shirt, but no trousers. What's that all about?
He's a bit of a streaker.
Well, why, right? Why has Winnie the Pooh got no trousers?
Mm.
Eeyore has just got a bow, I think. So I remember someone tying a bow in Eeyore's hair.
Yeah,
Tigger's naked.
Yeah.
Why is Winnie the Pooh even sort of making that cursory nod to human fashion when the others don't seem to give a shit?
Yeah. I think Eeyore's bow's a bit saucy. It's a bit sexy, isn't it? It's like, ooh.
Yeah.
How's your little bow?
Yeah, Eeyore's fun. I can't really work Eeyore out.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what's his motivation.
He represents depression. I didn't know if you know that.
He's pretty miserable, yeah.
He is, there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
But everyone loves him still.
I don't think he's a bit of a prick.
Cheer up. Kanga doesn't really have
Who's
anything.
Who's Kanga?
The mother of Roo. Kangaroo.
Who's Roo?
You know Kanga and Roo?
I've eliminated these characters
really?
From my mind, yeah.
Kanga and Roo.
Are they in Winnie the Pooh?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You don't know these two?
Well, I probably do, but I don't remember them.
Well, one of them's a mummy kangaroo.
Yes.
And the other one is a baby.
A Joey.
A Joey, yeah.
Yeah.
And neither of them are clothed, I don't think.
Well, see, this is my problem, right?
Piglet. T-shirt.
Yeah, well, hasn't Piglet... I'm trying to really remember Piglet now. Has Piglet got, like a onesie on? What's Piglet wearing?
Like a little pink and white striped T-shirt.
Piglet's got, like, a little bodysuit thing on.
Yeah.
See, there's no consistency in the 100 Acre Wood. So, in Beatrix Potter, for example...
Yeah.
Okay, it's consistent. They're all dressed sort of, like, repressed Edwardian servants. That's all how they're dressed. Like, sort of full-on dress and frills and cuffs and things. Mm. Even if you're a rabbit, that's what you're wearing, okay? So there's consistent... You go... So when I approach that universe, I can go, okay, I appreciate that those animals wear clothes. Whereas in Winnie the Pooh, it's like, why is this dickhead got a red T-shirt on? This thing is naked. Donkey's got a bow.
No, I completely agree. It's madness.
Bullshit. But I'm just saying, Winnie the Pooh, either take your T-shirt off or put some trousers on.
Yeah.
But the also, right. That's just not what I would ever... That's not the order you get dressed in. Like, you know, sometimes I'm at the gym and, like, the guy next to me pop his T-shirt on. Or pop his, this is right, I've seen this. Pop his shirt on.
Yeah.
Pop his socks on.
Yeah.
Do up his shirt. Do up his cuffs. Put his cufflinks on. Put his tie on. Still got his willy and bollocks out. Yeah. Right? And the last thing he'll put on is his pants.
That's odd.
But you must want people to see your penis.
Yeah. Do you reckon it's like a mating call?
If so, he's wrong, because even if we were to mate, I mean, I'm flattered, but it's not going to result in any... gym offspring. It's just not.
No, you're right.
Some guys will just, like, they'll get dressed at the mirror and they'll be, like, drying their hair and everything, and they'll put, like, one leg up on the side and dry under there.
Oh god,
I wouldn't do that at home.
Yeah.
And one of the researchers who worked on this series of What's Up TV on Sky One, returning to your TVs January the 7th 2017, one of the researchers, right, this is so funny, on the back of his phone case, I was out on a shoot with him,
yeah,
on the back of his phone case was embroidered, or like stenciled, yeah, simply the word Nang.
Oh wow.
Which, if you're not in Britain and under 25, so I mean I'm not under 25, but the word Nang, I said to him, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And I mean, do you know what it means?
That's Nang. That's cool, great.
Well, apparently it's a multi-purpose word, according to Emmanuel.
Right.
So he said that Nang can either be deployed to you, deploying, oh, wow. Nang.
Did he say the actual word?
Deploying Nang. Yeah, but he said Nang can be used to mean good.
Right.
Oh, last night was so Nang.
That was Nang, yeah, yeah.
Or that girl is so Nang. Or it can also be like annoying or bad. So like, oh man, it's just too Nang.
What? But that's like completely contradictory.
Yeah.
You can't use the same word for something that's good and bad.
Well, the one when I was a kid was sick.
Sick, yeah. That's sick.
Which confused the heck out of people older than me, because sick means ill. And also, when I was a young man and UK Garage was quite the thing, then what we all used to say when we liked a song, and Miss Dynamite immortalised it in a song herself with Sticky, was we used to say boo. So, boo. If something's good, you say boo.
Oh, my God. I am too young to
I can't
that.
Believe your face. Oh, my God. I just feel about 100.
I am horrified.
Have you ever heard the Miss Dynamite and Sticky song, Boo?
No.
Okay.
Do you want to sing it to me?
And then we say, boo. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It doesn't go like, it's wow. Not a children's song. So, you say boo. Honestly, ask your parents.
Okay.
Or older siblings. We used to say boo, which obviously was ironic because boo is something you would say when something's bad.
Yeah, yeah.
On that bombshell, I think we should...
Mind blown.
Another powerful, thought-provoking, weighty episode of yesterday's news. I met Rachel Weiss. Oh, I'll pick that name up off the floor. No, but I interviewed her for work. She's nice, right?
Yeah, she seems nice.
But she's quite stiff and proper. And didn't seem, in the context of the interview, to sort of have a massive sense of humour.
Ah, so she didn't care for any mummy references you dropped.
She did not. Which, and you can never tell, and I always maintain this when people say, like, oh, celebrities aren't very nice or whatever. It's like, well, if you meet them for 5 minutes, it's quite pressurised, there's camera in their face, who knows? And we were sort of in this hotel room. I was, like, one of many TV crews going in and out. As I sat down, because I always, the bit before this camera starts rolling, I try and think of something interesting to say in order to get the conversation going. Much like a first date. So I said to her, oh, Rachel, because it was about the lobster. I said, I really loved the film, but can I just say, this is going to be a bit awkward for me. She said, why? And I said, well, because I have fancied you ever since I was 9 years old and the first time I saw the mummy.
That's weird.
Is that weird?
That is weird. Yeah. Hello, personal I'm meeting in a professional setting.
Yeah.
Can I have a kiss?
That's basically it. And she went, oh, so you've got a thing for librarians, have you? To which I answered, I can't remember exactly what I said. I think I said, no, just you in the mummy.
What about the old woman from Harry Potter? She'd not do it for you. The old librarian.
For a minute, I was thinking of Argus Filch, the caretaker.
Oh.
No, he's not up my street. Mrs. Norris, that is cat. I just made a
pound that
mime.
Pussy.
Yeah, pound that pussy, quite literally. Yeah, expelliarmus all over its back.
Oh, I can't let my mum listen to this now.
This is a history podcast, allegedly. Yes.
One thing I will say about the mummy, Imhotep, the titular villain, the titular mummy.
Yeah.
He is based on a real man.
No.
Who was the first proper doctor in history, as in his texts referenced how to treat people without any aspersions to spirituality or magic on how to treat people.
Just scientific.
Yeah, purely scientific. And he will only ever be remembered as the man who chased Brendan Fraser through the desert.
He probably thought, dying 3,000 years ago, my legacy is secure. No. Because you weren't ready for Brendan Fraser and the mummy. Oh, wow. Well, that's Tutankhamun done.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, with the period you're particularly interested in, with the Great Fire, Samuel Pepys is just so much fun as a diarist. And I think that's the thing. Often when you read historical sources, that can seem fairly dry. I mean, often because they're written in a language that we just simply don't use every day. Pepys is a laugh and is an incredibly colourful character. How important is someone like him to what it is you study?
He's a great gateway drug into the rest of the source material.
I like the idea of that, as Samuel Pepys as a gateway drug.
Yeah.
Before you move on to harder diarists.
Yeah. But it's true. I mean, his diary clearly is so famous because it holds your hand and lets you experience the sights and smells of the 1660s. But actually, if you delve into the source material of the 17th century, particularly the later 17th century, which is where I research, you find that colour and that life in all of the pamphlets, and you find it in other diarist reports and memoirs. I mean, there's so many characters that come out of the archive. John Evelyn's got a really interesting diary, and it's quite nice to sometimes look at the two diaries in opposition to one another, because quite often they record the same events. Quite often they're together as well, and you find that Samuel Pepys records being with John Evelyn in a carriage, for example, but John Evelyn makes no mention of it in his diary.
He didn't like Pepys as much as Pepys liked
him. I don't know. I think he did towards the end, but certainly in the 1660s, I think the friendship was one way. There's a guy called Thomas Elwood, who was a Quaker, and he was an apprentice of John Milton for a while, and he left a tremendous memoir of his entire life, and it's fantastic. Then you get people like Margaret Cavendish, who writes the memoir of her life, and one of my most favourite quotes of hers is that all I desire in life is fame. I just think it's fantastic. There are so many characters and so many... And I think that's part of it, part of the interest for me anyway of the 17th century, is that this is where you actually can start to relate to people a bit
better. They're more tangible, aren't they, these people? They feel more real.
But then also, if you're actually in the archive, and this just demonstrates me being a bit lazy, but if you're in the archive, the writing's a little bit easier to decipher as you get to the 17th century.
Yeah.
So it's easier for a researcher to go in and look at the documents. I mean, believe me, it still takes probably a full day to transcribe one thing, but it's easier than earlier, for me anyway.
One of the things, bizarrely, that people in this country harp on about is, oh, we haven't been invaded for 950 years. But of course, that's simply not true. Because in 1688... the Glorious Revolution, William of Orange was invited in, but the country was invaded by Dutch soldiers. How much of a huge turning point is that for the country?
It was massive, but then change was already happening, and the Civil War had already laid the ground for that kind of thing. And again, it boiled down to this competition between Parliament and the Crown. James was tolerated, James II as king. He inherited the throne when his brother Charles II died. And even though he was a Catholic, I mean, there had been a huge furore about his Catholicism, and there had been efforts to make Charles II's illegitimate son, the Duke of Monmouth, king in his place. But he became king, and he was tolerated for a while because he didn't have a male heir. His daughter was married to William of Orange, and, well, it was considered that she would be the natural heir with an alliance with William. But then, miraculously and unexpectedly, James II, who was not he was no spring chicken. He had a young wife, and his young wife became pregnant, and this wife of his had a son. Mm. And this is where everything started to go wrong for James II, because people started to realise, oh, goodness, OK, if he's got a son, then that son's going to be a Catholic, so James isn't just a blip. We could have the country converted to Catholicism again. And this taps into this deep-rooted fear of Catholicism and absolutism and the danger that it might pose for Parliament.
James's other daughter, Anne, is even writing to Mary saying that she felt that it was a false pregnancy, that it was being faked. I mean, that's how much people mistrusted Catholics fundamentally.
Yeah, there was this idea that the baby had been switched, or a baby had been put there in a bedpan during the birth, because apparently there hadn't been enough witnesses to see that actually James's wife had given birth to a son. So yeah, people really didn't trust it. But then subsequently, James II had a crisis of some sort, probably a nervous breakdown, when William of Orange arrived on British shores, and he basically did a runner through the Great Seal of the Realm into the Thames and scarpered, and then regretted it for the rest of his life.
It's very much a Michael Douglas in Falling Down moment, getting out of the car and storming off. Also, just quickly, because we're nearly out of time, I think the 17th century has my favourite monarch in any way. Certainly the most fun, Charles II.
Yeah.
Is a real laugh. Is that what you get from the sources, that you think this guy seems top-notch?
Yeah, he's a very funny character. I mean, you should never, as a historian, diagnose psychological things. But if I was pushed, I would probably say he's got quite a few sociopathic traits.
Really?
I really think so. He was a pragmatist to the absolute core. That's why I don't fully trust his Catholic conversion on his deathbed. I think he was probably just hedging his bets. And some of the stories about him can be quite dark. I mean, there's one story that Samuel Pepys relays whereby Charles II dissects a fetus that he believes to be his miscarried child from one of his mistresses, and he dissects it on his own. I mean, it's different times and everything, but that's still pretty dark. Interest?
Wow. No telly then.
There was no TV, so dissect your miscarried fetus.
God almighty.
So, I mean, there are some things. And again, as I said, it's, you know, it was a different time. Different things were interesting. But I think even so, that's quite a dark thing to
do. Hannibal Lecter.
In
my mind, he's always been the king that brought back partying.
He did. And he loved his women. And he had he had a respect for women. And he was able to be played by many of them. Mm. Or at least he let them believe that he was. Yeah, he is one of the most interesting. I think the Stuarts are funny. I think you get a clever one and then a dumb one. And then a clever one, then a dumb one. James I was a bright spark with many flaws. Charles was not so bright and very stubborn. Charles I.
Far too stubborn if you end up being executed for your stubbornness. Yeah.
And then his son, James II, mirrored those traits, I think.
Wow. Speaking of bringing people to justice, Perkin Warbeck.
Mm.
I mean, you heard his statement.
Yeah.
Recorded live from the scaffold in 1499. Yeah, so Perkin Warbeck, is this a name you'd ever heard?
No. By God, what a good name it is.
What a good name. And also, what a colourful little life.
Yeah.
Even if you do end up getting hanged, he must have been thinking there, just like, I'll tell you what, I've crammed a lot in.
Yeah.
So he's either a Flemish merchant who, originally the Irish, apparently turned up in Ireland and they went, you look a bit like Richard Duke of York. I don't know how they'd know that, because A, no one has seen Richard Duke of York since he was 9.
Yeah.
B, they didn't have fucking Twitter. You know what I mean? Why would these randoms in Ireland have seen a kid who was last seen in the Tower of London before he was even 10 years old? So I don't know where they got that from.
Right.
But then all his aunt, the King of France, the King of Scotland, all went, you might just be Richard Duke of York. No one went, hang on, who the fuck is this?
Yeah.
But it's either that or he was Richard Duke of York. And that's my thing, because I just think, would all these important people really have got on board with this conspiracy? Because at some point someone would have gone, guys, this is just mental. Look, we all hate Henry VII. That's a given. But this twat, like, seriously, we're going to let him be king. What do you think? Do you think he was the real child who'd been on the run since the age of 9, or a Flemish merchant?
Firstly, I think him and, was it Hummels, the other guy?
Well, Hummels is a Bayern Munich centre-back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's that guy?
Not the other pretender to the throne.
No, the guy we were just talking about, the German bloke who flew to Scotland.
Hess.
Yes. They have very similar...
I think him and Schweinsteiger, am I right in thinking? Yeah.
They have very similar outlooks on life. Just like, yeah, grab it, do it. Go to Scotland, go to Ireland, pretend to be I don't really know. I kind of think, fair play to him. Either way, it's a hell of a story. The Chancellor in me thinks, you know what? Yeah, let's just say he was a Chancellor.
Yeah.
Like, that's more of a romantic idea in my mind
yeah.
than actually being him and then getting killed for being someone.
This is why I don't think he was Richard, Duke of York.
Right.
Yes, he was captured and he was tortured. Natch. Henry VII made sure of that. But after he was tortured and he confessed and said, oh, no, I'm just a Belgian, he was then allowed to live at the royal court. As if Henry VII had thought that this was actually the rightful heir to the throne. He goes, I don't give a shit what he said. Just people fall downstairs every day. Know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
But he didn't. He just went, oh, look, it's just a little Belgian lad. Just let him live at court. And then he tried to escape and he was like, fuck's sake.
He really should have just thought, you know what? You've done all right for a little Belgian lad.
Yeah.
You've made it to Ireland and now you're in the royal court. Just chill.
Because if you were Richard Duke of York, okay, fine, but at least you're alive. If you weren't, you're
the luckiest Belgian
yeah.
in the history of
if you weren't,
Belgian people.
You're just a random Belgian dude who, even if you look at it on the face of it, okay, you didn't get to be king, but you still get to live in the English royal court, whereas before you were just a merchant just toddling around Antwerp doing bollock all. But then someone tried to convince him in 1499 to escape, and he went, yeah. I'd be like, do you know what, mate? It's all right. I've got PS4.
What's the equivalent?
What's the equivalent in those days?
A busty maid.
Yeah, just a buxom wench to ravish at his convenience.
Yeah.
Both their convenience. Obviously, it's consensual. let's not get bogged down in Tudor sex crimes that didn't happen.
So you think he was...
I think he was a pretender. What do you think?
Yeah, Chancellor. I want to believe he's a Chancellor. Otherwise, it's just a bit grim.
Well, I mean, what happened to them anyway is grim. A 12-year-old boy and a 9-year-old boy were smothered to death. Basically, because
by Richard III,
yeah,
who I saw David Tennant play, and they kind of touched upon that.
Whether he ordered it himself or it was his best mate, the Duke of Buckingham, basically what it is everybody thinks that Richard III did it because he wanted to be king. If he did do it, which all the evidence points to, essentially what looks like happened is because there was, after Edward IV died, his wife or widow's family were very powerful in the court, and whoever controlled Edward V, the 12-year-old, would have control of England because Edward V wouldn't be able to assume power in the country until he was 18. So basically, they hated Richard III. Edward IV's widow's people on one side, Richard III on the other side, this poor 12-year-old lad in the middle. And once Richard got hold of him, his only option was to not leave him alive. In a very unusual situation where it's kill your nephews or die yourself, which comes up very rarely in life.
I think someone should pick that up as a script, man. That R. Scott story is...
I'm available to play Captain Scott as well. Like, I just want to say...
Just put it out there.
Mate, you could be Captain Oates, the guy who goes outside and says, I'll be sometime.
I'm good to freeze to death, man. I can do a good freeze to death.
Oh, that's the problem. I don't want to do it like The Revenant. We're going to have to do it in a studio. I'm not doing it in actual cold conditions.
Mate. Pick up Leonardo DiCaprio, though. That was an amazing performance,
If we can get Leo in it, actually.
Yeah, then, you know, it's we won't get paid, though, because the budget we have to probably will go to Leo.
Well, I'm not giving him the lead. Got no chance. Like, I've already bagged him that. Before we go, one of the things I want to introduce is idioms. So little
Wicked.
Sayings and where they come from.
Wicked.
Which is something I'm particularly interested in. Do you know the saying, daylight robbery?
Yes.
So, mate, what are you talking about? That's daylight robbery.
Yes.
Do you know where it comes from? From something called the window tax.
Oh, wow.
Which was introduced by William III in 1696. It was a tax levied on windows or window-like openings of properties. So the more windows you have, the more tax you had to pay. So basically, William III needed money, so he and his government kind of looked around and thought, what can we tax that we're not taxing? And obviously he was going past someone's house and thought, do you know
windows.
What? Cha-ching, everybody's got windows.
Oh, that is messed up.
We're laughing. Some wealthy people saw it as a status symbol and demonstrated their wealth by ostentatiously building homes with loads of windows.
Wow.
I like that, Flash. And some people went to great pains to avoid paying it, and many windows were bricked up for that reason. So sometimes in, for example, central London, you'll see old buildings and they will have a window frame but with bricks across it, and that's why.
Because they had to block out the windows because of tax. And that's where daylight robbery came from.
That's where daylight robbery, because people said it was a tax on daylight.
So it's daylight. That's amazing.
Because they were stealing their daylight by making them pay to have a window.
That is insane.
We're nearly out of time. One of the things we do each week is do an idiom or we do some trivia. And I thought this week I would do some trivia.
Ooh.
And it's also pertinent because this week in history, on the 28th of November 1291, Eleanor of Castile died. So Eleanor of Castile was the wife of Edward I. Edward I, for those of you listening at home who don't know, is the king in Braveheart, okay, who didn't throw Piers Gaveston out a window. Also, Mel Gibson Not William Wordsworth. William Wallace.
William Wordsworth. William that would have been a yeah. much better film. Mel Gibson is William Wordsworth.
Yeah, Edward I didn't throw anyone out a window. Also, his wife didn't sleep with William Wallace / Mel Gibson. That didn't happen. So I think Braveheart has given lots of people a very skewed view of Edward I and English history. But Edward I, 28th of November 1291, his wife, Eleanor of Castile, died, okay? So he was on campaign in Scotland, obviously. This was the man who gave himself the nickname the Hammer of the Scots.
God, I wish I had thought of giving myself a nickname
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, the Hammer of the North.
Yeah, oh, come
yes.
on.
Yeah, that's what we're
that's going on
now.
My business cards.
Edward was devastated, though, when she died and rushed back south to make arrangements for her funerals. And her body had to be taken to Westminster in stages. And Edward had a beautiful memorial cross erected in each...
How old are you?
erected in each of the places where they stopped with her body on the procession. And that's why in England, there are 12 places with cross after the town name. So the ones that remain... Lincoln, Grantham, Stamford, Geddington, Northampton, Stony Stratford, Woburn, Dunstable, St Albans, Waltham, Cheapside, and the best known of all, Charing Cross. That was the final stop before they got to Westminster Abbey to bury her. There was a memorial there to Eleanor of Castile.
That is extravagant.
Yeah, that's OTT, isn't it?
Yeah, that's like having 12 funerals.
Especially for like the royal attendants who've got fuck all money and are just dirt poor peasants. When they got to like the 8th of 12, you're like, oh, like, yeah. Seriously.
We got like another four to go.
We got to crack on. We've got to be in Westminster in 4 days, lads. Get her on the van. But that's where we get Charing Cross and all the other crosses in England from.
That is fascinating.
One thing I like to do on the show is I do idioms.
Right.
So little pieces of language that we say all the time. And this week's... I've got such a good one for next week. I'm just trailing ahead. So if you are listening to this and you're thinking, God, I might listen next week. Next week's idiom is blinding, let me tell you. But I've got a good one this week as well. So I don't want to downplay
not
this
not as good. Yeah, okay, fine. Save your better idiom for next week. That's cool.
Have you ever heard the phrase, turn a blind eye?
Of course.
You have. So, for example, I saw Nicole nick my last jammy dodger.
Classic.
But I turned a blind eye. That's the only example I could think of because
yeah,
I'm
11. Really good one.
To ignore something, really. And I suppose the implication is to ignore something, but it's not that important. You kind of let it slide.
Yeah.
Like when you see someone feeding the dog under the table. Actually, it doesn't work because I'm normally feeding the
dog
under
the table. Yeah, I was going to say, I always do that.
But if I feed the dog under the table and you sort of see someone, oh, stop feeding the dog. But they're turning a blind eye. The expression is said to originate with famous English naval hero Admiral Nelson, who during the Battle of Copenhagen in 1801, apparently deliberately raised his telescope to his blind eye because he only had the one eye, because he'd lost it. Careless. Thus, ensuring he would not see any signal from his superior telling him to withdraw from the battle. So what he did, because he wanted to keep fighting, he put his telescope up to his blind eye and went, no, I can't see anything, guys. But do you not think that someone on the ship would go, that's your wrong eye, boss?
Yeah, hang on a minute.
Yeah, when the other eye's rolling around looking at you.
Oh, wow, that's where it comes from. That's quite cool. That's interesting.
How stupid were people in 1801 that they fell for that when he went...
Well, they were probably all, like, drinking, chilling, not really looking.
They're not in Marbella.
I know, it's like battleground.
And they're having a mojito.
Yeah, I know, but I see them as being, like, quite like, way.
Yeah, way, lads on tour. So, Nicole, that's our allotted time up. Have you enjoyed yourself?
Yeah, it's been fun.
Do you feel like you've learnt anything?
I have learnt stuff. I mean, I'm definitely going to take the origin of that idiom and just go around telling people.
Good. Could have just kept it to the last 2 minutes. That was
yeah, pretty much.
That was the Yesterday's News Best Bits special edition for New Year's. Normal service will resume next week, but to see us into 2017, here are some of my favourite outtakes. Happy New Year. Thanks, Joe. Yesterday, agents of the King raided the house of noted London midwife Elizabeth Sellier. Okay, well, fucking hell.
Ooh. Sorry, am I from present or past?
I think you're just you, yeah.
I'm me, okay.
You're just you. Hey, just be yourself, man.
So what can you tell us about the investigation today?
Well, today we conducted a search of the house of one Elizabeth Celia and discovered incriminating evidence, especially fucking hell.
Wow, is he South African?
I don't know where he's from. Especially in her Miltava.
Yeah.
With some of these being Catholic, as she was commissioned to do so by some of the grand ladies she met while serving as... Oh, fuck me, I've got the tensile wrong on that. Just kill me. Well, I've been in jazz clubs and stuff, and I think, oh, just shut up. Like, just get on with it.
I'm yet to experience my first London jazz club.
Don't bother.
No.
It's just really boring, and it's loud as well. So you can't, like, because you think, oh, you take a young lady there for the ambiance, and it's just...
Wearing your roll-up neck.
Yeah, I probably was, because for one stage I did favour them. And then I wore them and saw myself on television and realised I looked like a weird sort of French mime. So I stopped wearing it. Have you ever seen the children's show Bagpuss?
The pink cat.
Yeah, the pink cat. You and I were both...
How old are you, by the way?
Well, I'm not old enough to have watched Bagpuss, but I've seen it since as an adult because I've got a full and vibrant life. So I sit and watch Bagpuss during the day and masturbate. So that's getting out. Oh, hello. Someone's protein bar's coming back to say hello, isn't it? Hello? Testing, cool. Okay. Hello, old friend. Okay, sorry. Oh, I could really hear that, like, in my brain. Betray your god for a few pieces of money. Is there a single virtue now remaining amongst... Sorry, I've gone Irish. Is there a single virtue amongst you? Okay. What? Fuck, I can't remember the accent from before. It was kind of like a country bumpkin, wasn't it? A bit like that. Okay. Thanks, Joe. Some angry Germans there. So, as a bit of... Oh, dear.
Right.
Imagine that on the news.
Some angry Germans. It's so hot. It's so hot. Oh, wow. Brilliant.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Angry Germans.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Right. God, okay. Oh, those crazy Germans, right.
Nice.
Okay.
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 Okay, good.
Fucking hell. Oh, God. Right, okay. Thanks, Joe. Some angry Germans.
Okay.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
I'm so sweaty. Right.
Oh, God.
Oh. Okay.
Right. Okay. Oh, Jesus.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. Some angry Germans. Oh, I don't know why that's so funny. It's just... Oh, God.
Oh, no. Okay.
Oh. The proverbial shit, which had previously been winding. Okay. Here's Joe Forrester with more on what this could mean for the country. Swallowing some spittle. Sorry. Okay. For God's sake, please don't cause any trouble with the Spanish. Fucking fuck me. What the fuck is that?
That wasn't bad.
I like to think that spirit of daring and adventure lives on in every Englishman today. It doesn't. But
yeah, not. I don't go method. I mean, that's a whole new debate.
Mm.
Masturbate.
Next up, the date is the 1st of September. No, it's not. December. Can't even read the date. First up, the date is 1st of September. Fucking hell. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus.
What day is it?
Good. There you go, mate. See? Bang.
Oh, God, I thought it was in the swamps of Alabama themselves.
Oh, mate. One, that Oscar, just, I mean, it can't be far away.
Audio journey.
It really did. Really powerful, powerful stuff. How do Scandinavian people talk? Oh, I'm from Stockholm. No, that's Dutch.
Oh, hurdy good, shout man. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Just bork, bork.
Yeah. Oh.
Just do it, Swedish chef from the Muppets.
Hey, Joe, thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for having
me. Thanks for having me on this show.
Yeah, I've got him. Yeah, yeah.
Let all men know how empty and verseless...
Oh, no, where's he from now? That's where's he from now? There we go. That's Christmassy, isn't it? Oh, genocide and serial killers. Wow. I'm a hoot at Christmas.
When you broadcast and you can't swear, so I do all my swearing.
You
for
do
the
it
week.
All here?
Here, yeah.
Bum. Can I say bum?
I say bum copious.
Can you say bum pants?
Yeah.
That's a particularly favourite phrase of mine.
Bum pants.
Bum pants, yeah.
What other kind are there?
It's just a good phrase, that's all. Poo pants is another one.
Lols, bants and wet pants. That's what one of my friends says all the time.
Is that your is that your Tinder bio?
Yeah, lols, bants and wet pants. Get in the van.
There you go,
dude. Okay.
And on that note.
Now we're cooking.
Please don't leave me. No, please don't leave me. No, please don't leave me. It's Christmas.